Good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Workforce, Labor and Economic Development, Finance and Policy Committee. It is it March 24th? Thank you. And I represent Dave Pinto, one of the two co-chairs of the committee, along with Representative Dave Baker. Members, we have a number of bills up and a presentation from Deed. We're going to start with our minutes. We do have a quorum. And in the absence of Chair Baker, I'll ask, Vice Chair Mecklen, maybe I'll ask you if you would mind to move approval of our minutes from March 18th.
So moved.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mecklen. Members, any additions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the March 18th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Thank you. We have our minutes. And so, members, we're going to be shifting bills around a little bit in the order. We're starting with Chair Frazier's bill, House File 4097. This is a fiscal bill, so just the motion from Chair Frazier is just bring it before the committee. And Chair Frazier, if you can present House File 4097 to us.
Give me a second to pull up my docs. I was slated last.
So you were slated last. Yes, you've been bumped all the way to the beginning. We were kind of missing a few authors and a couple things happening. And no problem, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Sure. And there is an amendment, Chair Frazier, if you want to move the amendment to House File 4097 and just tell us what's going on with it.
Mr. Chair, please do move the amendment. The amendment is adding another $1 million to the bill that I'll be discussing today. If you need more detail, I can have staff walk through it.
Okay, we can see if folks have questions, but otherwise we're just getting the bill in the shape the bill's author wishes.
That's correct.
Okay, so members, any further discussion on the A1? Not hearing any. All in favor of approval of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So the bill is amended, and Chair Frazier, please present it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, small businesses are central to every one of our districts. They employ nearly half of Minnesotans' workforce and help drive local economies, but many entrepreneurs, especially those without traditional access to capital or business resources, face real barriers when starting or growing a business. That's where these programs come in. For about 15 years, the Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program and the Small Business Assistance Partnership Program have helped connect entrepreneurs with trusted advisors, community lenders, and the capital they need to succeed. House File 4097 strengthens that work by adding $2 million to the Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program, Revolving Loan Account, and $1 million to the Small Business Assistance Partnership Program distributed through organizations that already have contracts and proven track records. These programs operate through a competitive process, ensure funding reaches both Greater Minnesota and the metro area, and require reporting to the Department of Employment and Economic Development so we can track outcomes and maintain accountability. Many of us likely have small business in our districts that have benefited from these efforts, which is why the programs have historically received strong bipartisan support. So I want to thank my co-authors, Representative Wayne Johnson, Representative Pete Johnson, Representative Lesnar Carr, and Representative Norris for their partnership on this bill. With that, Chair, I will yield to testifiers.
Thank you so much. So we'll go to the testifier. If you can please identify yourself, welcome, and then proceed with your testimony.
Morning, Chair Pinto. My name is Zach Tabbitt. I'm the Vice President of Economic Opportunity at the Initiative Foundation, located in Little Falls. We serve the 14 counties and two Native nations located in central Minnesota, and I'm here today to talk about the importance of the Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program and the Small Business Assistance Partnership Program. Not only for the Initiative Foundation, but this is also an important program for our peers across the state. These programs support the delivery of both technical assistance and lending capital to small businesses across central Minnesota and beyond. Additionally, these programs leverage private investment into small businesses by providing banks with lending-ready clients and by filling gaps in capital stacks. An example of this work includes one of the most popular restaurants in St. Joseph, which draws crowds from across the state for incredible food and atmosphere. The owner accessed the Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program and has successfully paid that loan off. Another example is Yashir Kombucha in Brainerd. This business has been supported from the very beginning through technical assistance and training provided through the Small Business Assistance Partnership Program. This has helped the owner operate more effectively and to be a prepared loan client as he's accessed loans for expansions with both banks and gap lenders. These programs are even more important now because of changes to federal funding at agencies such as the SBA, USDA, and the CDFI fund. Many of the federal funding sources we have utilized to support our work are paused or are no longer available. This includes SBA Prime Awards, the USDA's Rural Business Development Grant Program, and technical assistance awards through the CDFI fund. The unpredictability of federal funding has significantly changed how we operate, but because of support from legislative programs such as these, we have helped to fill those gaps. The Small Business Assistance Partnership Program and Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program are proven funding sources that help small businesses get the support they need to succeed. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And Chair Frazier, I think that's your only testifier you brought in, correct, sir?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll see if there's any other public testifiers. Anybody else wish to testify? So seeing none, we'll close testimony. I will have a question, but I'll just see if any members do. Maybe I'll do mine and as folks are thinking. So I wanted to have Deed just tell us about, so the funds in the bill as amended would come from the Minnesota Forward Fund, and if Deed can just provide, Mr. Bowdery can, just really just educate members of the committee about that fund as we'll be heading into budget season. And so if you can identify yourself, Mr. Bowdery, and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Devin Bowdery, Government Relations Director at Deed. The Forward Fund is a program that was passed in 2023 for large-scale business expansions. I want to say $400 or $500 million was appropriated at that time. And right now, I think we're sitting at about $113 million or so left in that fund. So
okay.
That's the remaining balance.
All right, thank you. Yeah, maybe just stay up there, and we'll see, members. Is there any discussion or questions? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Chair Frazier, for the bill. I'm looking at trying to, as I'm unfamiliar with this, as I'm new to the committee, it says this is for emerging, where am I at here, for emerging entrepreneur loan program. Are there any requirements of it can only be within the first 5 years that the business existed, or can they continue getting this funds in perpetuity?
Chair Frazier, if you know, or Mr. Bowdery.
There's no particular timeline.
Mr. Bowdery, maybe we'll have you, yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, no, there's no particular early stage, but it's usually targeted toward small companies looking to grow or upscale a little bit.
Representative Mueller? Oh, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. I guess, when I look at programs like this, I think it's really important, especially as I'm looking at places in my area, as people are starting their own businesses. Of course, having a business-friendly economy would also be helpful. But when we talk about emerging businesses, I guess I would really encourage, and again, maybe this has been going on for a while, but if this is supposed to be for emerging businesses, I would hope that we would be able to say, okay, let's continue on, and if you're successful in this, let's get you started, and if you're successful, then you don't need to be applying for this anymore. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. I will see if any other questions or discussion. And so seeing none, we'll go to Chair Frazier to finish, and maybe... Thank you, Mr. Bowdery. Chair Frazier, we'll go to you to close. Maybe you can just talk about, in your close, part of your thinking about drawing these funds from the Forward Fund for this purpose. Chair Frazier.
Yeah, and let me just, Mr. Chair, if I may speak to Representative Mueller's question, because I thought it was a great point. And we should note that once they've gone through this Emerging Entrepreneur Program, there are other, when they're successful, there are other programs and they can then draw from. They would not be continuing to access this program. So that duly noted, I think they had worked out a way to address that particular issue that you raised. So thank you for raising it. Mr. Chair, the request for the extra $1 million coming from the Forward Fund is actually coming from an interest account that these funds have are drawing. So it's not drawing directly from those funds, but from the interest that has accrued over the years from the Forward Fund program.
I mean, Mr. Chair, I'll just confirm that your amendment, I think, changed the original $2 million to be coming from the Forward Fund as well rather than the general fund.
Correct.
So probably just if you can, as you close, just sort of the thinking in terms of drawing funds from that fund. And I guess anything else you want to say about the bill?
Thank you, Chair. The main reason is we want to make sure that we're supporting small businesses during this time. I think Rep. Mueller mentioned a not very business-friendly environment, but what's happening is, Mr. Talbert testified to this, there's really some uncertainty because of what's happened at the federal level. Mm-hmm. Programs and resources that used to come through the SBA are no longer existent, or they've been cut drastically. We're really trying to provide a lifeline for these small businesses or for these individuals that want to get into business now. As I mentioned in my earlier testimony, over almost 50% of folks that are employed in the state are through small businesses. We want to make sure that we keep that activity going for the health of the state's economy.
Good. Thank you so much, sir. And then anything further you want to add about the bill?
No, looking forward to support. It's what we need now. We've identified an issue, and we're coming with solutions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Chair Frazier. And members of the public, a reminder that at the end of this week, it's the end of our policy deadlines, but then after that, we'll be having discussions about whatever budget actions we're able to take in the committee. We're going to have to sort of see where things stand, but this is something we'll consider at that point. So for now, the chair lays over House File 4097 as amended. Thank you, Chair Frazier. Thank you to your testifier for traveling and coming to the Capitol. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you
so much. And thank you, Mr. Bowdery, as well. Okay, so then Representative Berg, we'll have you make your way to the front. Members, House File 3878, the next bill up, is one that we discussed last week and had laid over the time, but the plan is to bring that to a vote. Representative Berg moves House File 3878 for a referral to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. I think that's the full name of that committee. But Representative Berg, we were discussing that because of the relationship with the airport, that seemed to be the correct next destination. You do have a DE2 amendment. And Representative Berg, my understanding is that amendment is, although it's written as a DE, it really is, that was more for stylistic purposes, and it's really the original bill, but then just a narrowing. And so you are moving the DE2 at this time?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. And I might ask Mr. Gehring from House Research, who's stepping in for Ms. Shaleen, to just make sure we all are clear about what the DE2 does. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, members, sure. So the DE2 amendment, as you said, is the style of the DE2, but the changes are primarily in the definition section. So I'd point you to lines 1.6 and 1.7, the definition of covered airport narrows the scope of the amendment to just the MSP airport, and then also the definition of covered worker, which starts on line 1.8, refers to an ordinance adopted by the MAC that includes a list of specific types of services and functions that are covered. I'm happy to share a copy of that with the committee members if they would like to see it.
Okay, thank you so much. And my understanding, Representative Berger, this is in response to some of the concerns expressed last week of a significant narrowing of the bill. Thank you. Members, we'll see if there first is any discussion or questions regarding the amendment. Seeing none, so then all in favor of approval of this author's amendment, the DE2, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the amendment passes. And so, Representative Berg, if you can please talk about House File 3878 as amended. We'll see if there's any final discussion and then go to a vote. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with the amendment, it just, as was mentioned, narrows the bill to just the main Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, and it also narrows the scope of the employees covered under it. So just to be perfectly clear, pilots and flight attendants are paid by the airline they work for, not the airport they might be at. For example, if I leave Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and I land in Detroit, I don't start getting paid by the Detroit Airport or JFK. I am paid by my airline. And so no flight crew would be covered under this. These are just the folks who work in our airports, who keep them clean, who bring loved ones to the planes via wheelchairs or carts, and really make our world-class airport what it is. And they're simply asking for fair wages and benefits. I do have folks here if there are questions from the committee.
Thank you so much. And we did have public testimony last week, so my plan is to go pretty quickly to a vote. But we'll see. Representative Bakeberg, you have something quick here. Representative Bakeberg.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative Berg. Just a question on the DE. I'm looking at line 1.20, the quality service wage. So have you had conversations about potential legal conflicts with this bill, and particularly, you know, from my understanding, the majority of the workers are represented by a union, mm-hmm. and linking all of the wages with this quality service wage, how does that interact with their negotiated contracts that they have? and particularly the benefit rate that's designated by MAC, and then there's some federal pieces there too. So how has that worked out with this bill?
And Representative Berg, obviously, if you want to call somebody up, phone a friend, welcome to do that too. Representative Berg.
Yeah, that is a great question. Thank you. I will have Sam Diaz come up and address that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And so once you get settled in, if you can identify yourself, and then love to get the answer to the question. Welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Samantha Diaz. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff of SEIU Local 26. So Mr. Chair and Representative Bakeberg, thank you for the question. So on the federal, just to try to go through a couple of the questions that you raised, it's important to set the context that this is not a foreign concept. The pegging wages and health care to the federal McNamara SEA. There are over a dozen airports that have some form of peg already to the SEA. And so what the McNamara Service Contractor Act is, it requires contractors and subcontractors performing services under prime contracts in excess of $2,500 to pay service employees in various classes no less than the wage rates and fringe benefits found in the locality. That's just what the SEA is. And I just want to make sure that I'm answering the other parts of your question.
I think there's a concern about the legal, the legality of it, or
yep.
Potential conflict with.
Yep.
The...
Again, this is done in airports across the country. Again, over a dozen, and this model was after the Healthy Terminals Act in New York and New Jersey, and so drafting with federal law and ERISA in mind to ensure that there is not that federal question.
Thank you. Representative Bakeberg, back to you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure you answered the question specifically, but I'll just, for the sake of time, just make my point and my concern. And I understand that this is done around the country. I think you said 12 different airports that do this. My concern is with the workers and the workers' ability to negotiate a contract, a fair contract, at their local entity. So, in my professional role, I negotiate my contract. The need of our local is different than the local next door to us. And I have significant concerns that when these workers go in and they're going to negotiate their contract, the salary and benefits is already going to be set for them by this bill. So, I have significant concerns with the bill in general, but this part in particular and the long-term impact that it will have on our workers at the airports. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I'll let Representative Berger let you respond in closing. We're getting members added to the list. Just a reminder, we had a very robust conversation about this. So I was going to let Vice Chair Mecklen close on behalf of the GOP side. Representative Schultz, do you have something very quick, sir? You had fairly robust discussion last time, I remember. Representative Schultz, you got something that you want to ask or say now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that this is very, very significant legislation. I think that there's a lot of questions. We've done in other hearings a lot of litigating of the legislation that's before us. So I don't want to feel rushed when we're in deadline week.
I understand you don't want to feel rushed, but we did litigate this quite a bit last week, and we do have a number of other bills. So.
And then we changed this bill, Mr. Chair, and there's big changes. As an example, do we have an idea? My understanding is this changes the scope for the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and I'm really curious as to their perspective on this change in the DE.
You mean the change that makes this be much less broad and have many fewer airports that applies to? You're curious as to whether they might have wanted more airports to be included. Is that what you're asking?
What I'm asking for is MAC's perspective on the bill.
Let's see if there's someone from the MAC who wishes to comment about the bill. If you can, come on up. And I will ask you to, we will need to move on pretty quickly, so I'll ask you to provide a brief answer if you can, and then we're going to go to Vice Chair Mecklen.
Good morning, Chair Pinto, members of the committee, Mitch Killian, Metropolitan Airports Commission. First of all, I want to make sure that you understand that we're not supportive of the overall bill. We think it will make us less competitive both when we're going out to recruit air service and also when we're trying to recruit and get investments in our concessions business. You discussed that at the last hearing, I know, quite a bit. To the amendment, few issues with us with that for us. First of all, if you think of the Metropolitan Airports Commission like a city, we're like the your local city government, and we have 800 employees, police, full-time fire, cut grass, plow snow, accounts receivable, accounts payable. That's 800 employees that we do, and we have a small HR department that oversees and administers for those 800 employees. There's another 20,000-plus badged employees at the airport, and this bill would now put our small HR department in charge of administering wage and benefit packages as directed by the federal government for 20,000-plus employees. And so can you imagine for your own local unit of government, if you would place that on your city hall to be, now you're the administer, you need a small labor department that has to administer that program. I would also add to the overall bill, would you put this bill on your local community to have you be competitive when you're trying to compete with surrounding communities that don't have it and maybe even national businesses that might come in? So I just leave it at that. That's the point to the amendment, I think.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So Vice Chair Mecklen to close.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Looking at the fiscal note, it says that there is no cost to this. However, when you read down below, MAC believes there is a strong likelihood this bill, if passed into law, would be challenged in court, and therefore MAC estimates it would incur significant legal expenses. Representative Berg, has you taken this into account, like what that would look like?
Representative Berg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Mecklen. What I took into account in this bill is the workers who have been patiently waiting for a living wage and benefit package that works for them. Most of us have between 4% and 6% of our whole total package go towards health care. For these workers, it's more like 20%. So we are trying to get workers a level playing field so that they can continue to do the work that makes Minneapolis-St. Paul a world-class airport and take care of their families. And when we discuss these kinds of issues, it is always the lowest paid workers who suffer in these scenarios. And we're just trying to make sure we're taking care of our workers. Representative Bakeberg is concerned about them. I know we're all concerned about them on this committee. So we're taking care of them with this bill.
And Vice Chair Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Well, and I can appreciate that. Perhaps I mean, they have a union that negotiates for them, correct? And it sounds like perhaps that's not working out so well. If they're being represented by the union and they have a less than sufficient, as you call, health care plan, which we're kind of hearing that from a lot of groups these days, maybe that's part of it, is that we're I don't think we have a health care problem. We have a health insurance problem in this nation. And it's become quite unaffordable rather than affordable. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you so much. Vice Chair Grimley, you have a quick thing?
Yeah, I do. And I agree with you, Representative Mecklen. We have a health insurance problem, a health care problem. And I think this is a great bill. And we had a bunch of workers here who were here asking us for this. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask a roll call.
Okay, a roll call hasn't been requested. There will be one to Representative Berg to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'm so excited to hear Vice Chair Mecklen call out the health insurance problem we have in this country, and we certainly are going to do work on that and other committees. Thank you so much for considering this today. I recommend a yes vote.
Thank you so much, Representative Berg, for your work. So with that, Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 3878, as amended, be recommended for referral to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee, and we'll have the clerk take the roll on the bill.
Chair Pinto?
Aye.
Chair Pinto, aye. Vice Chair Mecklen?
No.
Vice Chair Mecklen, no. Vice Chair Greenman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Greenman, aye. Representative Bakeberg?
No.
Bakeberg, no. Rep Berg?
Aye.
Rep Berg, aye. Rep Frazier?
Aye.
Rep Frazier, aye. Rep Hussein?
Aye.
Rep Hussein, aye. Rep Pete Johnson?
Aye.
Rep Pete Johnson, aye. Rep Wayne Johnson?
No.
Rep. Wayne Johnson, no. Rep. Kozlowski?
Kozlowski, aye.
Rep. Kozlowski, aye. Rep. Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Rep. Mueller, no. Rep. Schultz?
Schultz, no.
Rep. Schultz, no. Rep. Zelensikar? Zelensikar, no. Chair Pinto, there are 7 ayes and 6 nays.
And I do want to note, Madam Clerk, that Chair Baker is absent today, which is why his name was not read. And so there are 7 ayes, 6 nays. However, under the power sharing agreement that we're operating under, the bill does not pass. The motion fails. Thank you, members, for the discussion about it. And thank you, Representative Berg, and thanks to those who are here and are working on behalf of workers. With that, members, we're going to, I don't believe Representative Jones is here, and so we're going to move to the presentation by Deed. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Jones is here, okay. So we're going to go to Representative Jones. And I'm going to ask, Vice Chair Greenman, we're going to get to the Greenman bill right after the Jones bill. Vice Chair Greenman, I'll ask you if you may to move House File 3796 to bring that before us.
So moved.
Thank you. And then also, Representative Jones, you've got a DE2 amendment you'd like to be offered, yes?
Yes, I'd like to move the DE.
You may not move it, unfortunately.
I may not move it. Good.
Vice Chair Greenman may, though, if you're willing to do that again, Madam Vice Chair.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Jones, if you can just maybe tell us briefly about the bill and about the DE2 before we vote on that. Before we adopt the DE2, we probably should know what the bill does and so what the DE2 does briefly.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Yeah, this bill is basically giving employees the right to sit, a reasonable expectation of that where it is suitable. And the DE2 is clarifying some language. We had some back and forth with the Department of Labor and Industry, so they helped us kind of tighten up the bill in some ways, and then also providing a penalty for violations of this.
Thank you so much. And members, I'll note, my plan is to lay over House File 3796, not to go to a vote today. I will ask, do the author the courtesy of amending the bill in the way she wishes. So we'll just see if there's discussion or questions. And if not, I'll ask all in favor of approval of the DE2 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. That motion passes. And so if you can say anything further you wish about House File 3796 as amended, Representative Jones.
Yes, thank you again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to present this bill, House File 3796, to you today. I want to start with a question. What are you physically doing right now? Yes, you're breathing, hopefully. You're also probably reading, writing, and importantly, you are sitting. Can you imagine going through these committees standing the whole time? Or even, especially a floor session that goes way into the evening, standing the whole time? I'm bringing forward this bill, which would provide employees in Minnesota a reasonable and suitable expectation to be able to sit during the job. This came to me, came before me from constituents in my district who work at a museum. Their roles involve explaining exhibits to patrons. And quite frankly, it's not unlike some of the roles that our gold ties provide. They spend the majority of their time here at the Capitol, generally standing or being in one place for long periods of time, observing, answering questions, or proactively providing information to people around them near their post. So our gold ties, to my knowledge, have never been denied access to a stool or a chair. In fact, there are often, you know, their stools provided right there with those gold ribbons around them specifically designated for them. So being required to stand for long periods of time without an opportunity to sit can actually have negative health consequences. According to a meta-analysis published by NIH's National Library of Medicine, prolonged standing at work has been shown to be associated with a number of potential serious health outcomes, such as lower back and leg pain, cardiovascular outcomes, fatigue, discomfort, and pregnancy-related health outcomes. While this bill was inspired by constituents, I personally see the need of this type of protection as someone who just 3.5 weeks ago was pregnant. People who are pregnant have jobs and are very capable of doing their jobs, particularly when reasonable accommodations like a stool, a bench, or a chair is provided. This bill recognizes that not all roles have the opportunity to sit at all times. When I worked at Subway, for example, assembling sandwiches required me to work down the table, first starting at the meat and, or at the bread, and then the meat and cheese, and then the veggies, and then going down the table to ring up the customer. But this is a practical bill that supports Minnesota workers, giving them the opportunity to sit where it is reasonable and when it is reasonable, just as we have here to be able to do our jobs. Also, as I mentioned earlier, this bill has been developed in consultation with DLI. I also have a testifier. So thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Jones. So it looks like your first testifier is up there. If you can please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. And I'm going to ask folks, if you can keep it to just a couple minutes, that would be good. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Macklin, and others of the committee. For the record, I'm Michelle Mazur, the former president of Walker Worker Union. I worked at the Walker Arts Center for over 3.5 years, where I was elected union president 3 times. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota, and I'm here today in strong support of House File 3796, and I want to thank Representative Jones for carrying this legislation. I worked in visitor experience, the same department as gallery assistants, or in abbreviation, GAs. In a museum setting, they're commonly referred to as guards, but they answer your questions and preserve the artwork by reminding us of the gallery rules. In late 2023, Walker enacted several new policies without notifying the union, which seemed to focus on micromanaging our appearance of professionalism on the floor. It was when workers were told that they would need a doctor's note to continue using a stool or else they would have to stand. That's when we asked to meet with the employer to hear why this was so important. We'd been doing our jobs perfectly well when we had the choice to sit down from time to time. When we meet, they claimed that this wasn't a new policy, but that workers had never been allowed to use the stools, which was easily disproved because there's gallery assistants who've worked there for 22 years at that point. Still, they maintained that we couldn't, claiming one anonymous complaint that they never produced. We stand on Italian terrazzo floors made up of the hardest flooring materials, which is marble and granite, certainly less forgiving than concrete. And so when a GA was found sitting, they were escorted off the premises by security, even though they had submitted a doctor's note. So shortly after, we had an entire campaign around getting the stools back. We gathered over 600 signatures on our petition. We wrote a letter to the museum director signed by a majority of our bargaining unit. We handed over 50 postcards from union members to the head of education detailing their experiences. Patrons filled out comment cards urging Walker to allow their staff seating. We tabled in the sculpture gardens. Artists featured in the Walker reached out to offer support. One artist reached out after having just built cushioned benches as functional art pieces for the galleries, and they had them pointedly described on the plaque as being, quote, available for all to use. The overwhelming response to our campaign was, this is silly, just let them sit. We just recently closed up our contract, but seating was not something the employer would budge on, and we have 4 more years of this contract. We aren't coming to the legislature on a whim. We've done everything to address this on and away from the table. Also, forcing us to stand does cause actual health problems. NIOSH conducted studies that consistently reported increased reports of muscle pain, back pain, cardiovascular problems, and poor pregnancy outcomes. Finally, I'll note that we arrived here because there is precedent for this. Suitable seating was the law in Minnesota in 1887, and it remained in effect for 80 years. It only referred to women, which is probably why it was repealed. Meanwhile, other states like Wisconsin just eliminated the gendered language. Making this change to Minnesota statute would not make us a national outlier. And to quote the old law, the goal to, quote, permit the use of such seats by such employees to such an extent as may be reasonable for their preservation of their health, end quote, is a goal that should ring true for all today. Thank you for considering House File 3796. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks very much. Thanks for being here and for your testimony. I'm going to ask the next two testifiers, if you can come up, Lauren Schotthorst and John, I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name, sir, but Beshi. And then there'll be one more testifier after that. I think, Ms. Schotthorst, I think you're up first. And so once you get settled in, if you can please identify yourself and proceed. And again, with both of you, you can keep it to just a couple minutes. Ms. Schotthorst.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst. I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide business organization representing 6,300 businesses and over 500,000 employees across the state. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses. The Chamber appreciates the opportunity to raise a few questions about House File 3796, a seemingly simple piece of legislation requiring employers to provide seating for employees that might not be so simple to comply with as drafted. We have some fundamental definitional questions or scenarios to try and get a better sense of, as language that is up for interpretation can lead to litigation risks and unnecessarily subject a business to penalties if the employer doesn't guess correctly. What does the nature of the work reasonably permits the use of seats mean? It does not say when chairs are reasonably permitted and when it does not. Does this apply to the assembly line worker? Does this apply to seats at a packing line? Placing chairs where workers need to move could create obstructions to work, safety, and possible OSHA situations. How is that to be accounted for? Would nurses be legally entitled to sit in patient rooms while making rounds? Is an employer supposed to provide an employee with a chair while stocking lower shelves? Does a fast food employer have to install seating in the line preparing food directly for customers? Who determines what is considered an adequate number of seats, and what does reasonable proximity mean? Also, what does per violation mean? Is that for each employee, for each day of employment, per each chair, or per each not chair, in each possible discrepancy over the interpretation of these requirements? The point of the bill seems to be to allow workers to work while seated, but as drafted can be confusing. Reasonable people can have a legitimate disagreement on what is reasonable. Placing a penalty on employers for not complying with a vague statute is inherently a violation of due process. As we shared in the Senate, this bill introduces a vague but potentially consequential new requirement on employers of all sizes and industries. As a result, we ask that the committee continue to work on the language before advancing it. Thank you for the opportunity to raise these questions and issues of concern about the bill today.
Thank you, Ms. Shothorse. Yes, and to confirm, the plan, in fact, is to continue it, to lay it over today and have further discussion, but thank you. Mr. Beshe, welcome to you, and please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto, members of the committee. My name is John Beshe. I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Minnesota. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to provide comments in opposition to House File 3796. Just for context, NFIB represents about 10,000 small and independently owned businesses throughout Minnesota, and our members span every industry and serve local communities throughout Minnesota. NFIB opposes this bill, which requires employers to provide suitable seating for employees and to permit the use of those seats when the nature of the work reasonably permits. First and foremost, we do not believe that it is necessary to create a new state law to address this. Small businesses are already grappling with a growing list of workplace mandates, and we don't believe that the legislature needs to involve itself in every single workplace situation. With that said, we do have some specific aspects of this bill that cause particular concern and give rise to additional questions. Small businesses often operate in tight spaces that simply make it impracticable to maintain an adequate number of seats in reasonable proximity to the work area. This can be especially true in certain industries such as retail, food service, and hospitality. Depending on the workplace, small business owners could be forced to reconfigure their workspace and purchase additional equipment, all things that come with a cost that is difficult for small businesses to absorb. We are also concerned that this bill introduces some highly subjective concepts, such as maintaining an adequate number of seats and ensuring that such seating is located in reasonable proximity to the work area. Again, depending on the workplace, what constitutes reasonable proximity could vary depending on the perspective of the employee and employer. What is reasonable proximity for one employee may not be reasonable proximity for another. Similarly, what constitutes an adequate number of seats is vague and could be very much open to interpretation. For a small business owner without a dedicated HR or legal department, the subjectiveness of this requirement will make it nearly impossible to know whether they are truly compliant. Finally, this bill includes new punitive measures for failure to comply, which exposes small businesses to even more penalties and fines, even in instances where they may have acted in good faith. This is especially concerning considering the subjectiveness of some of the requirements that I previously mentioned. I want to thank you all again for the opportunity to provide comments, and we respectfully ask that you oppose this bill. I understand that it's being laid over, but those are our comments regarding the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Beshe. Yeah, thank you for being here. Thanks for your testimony. And I'll ask, Bernie Hess had also signed up to testify. I ask you to make your way up. And then please identify yourself once you get settled in, and a reminder us and folks to keep it relatively short here. Mr. Hess, a pleasure.
Chair Pinto, I am Bernie Hess from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. I did work in a grocery store for 20 years, or I was employed there, as some people would say. Five quick points on why we support this bill. One, ergonomically, I think it makes sense to move this forward, especially for cashiers. I look to Aldi's, which is a grocer that has its clerks that sit. They do up to 1,000 scans an hour when they're checking people out. So it adds to the efficiency of running a grocery store. We believe it also eliminates or reduces injuries, which translates into worker comp costs, which I think is smart. It also eliminates or reduces ADA complaints or requests for that. And in closing, remember, when you walk into a grocery store, nothing works without clerks. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. We'll see if, thank you so much. We'll see if there's anybody else from the public wish to testify. And not seeing any closed testimony. Representative Schultz, we'll go to you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be for the Department of Labor and Industry, if they
okay.
could come to the table.
We'll ask. I'm pretty sure that we've got Mr. Moore in the room, so he'll make his way on up. Or maybe a couple folks. And whoever will be answering, once you get settled in, if you can please identify yourself and then ask you to identify yourself, and then we'll go back to Representative Schultz to ask the question. Okay.
I'm Josiah Moore, Legislative Director at Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay.
And I'm Jessica Gross. I'm the Director of the Labor Standards Division at DLI.
Thank you so much. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Department, recent changes to the ergonomic statutes in 2023 and 2024 have been put into place, and I assume, given where this is going to be cited in state statute, that this is related to that conversation. I'm just curious if you could, number one, start with how has it been going at your enforcement of the ergonomic statutes?
And Mr. Moore?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for the question. Just to clarify, the DE today moved this out of OSHA. So when it came before the committee today, it was in 182, which is where OSHA and that ergonomic statute lives. But today's amendment moved it to Chapter 181, which is enforced by our Division of Labor Standards. So the bill, the enforcement of the bill wouldn't relate to enforcement of the ergonomics standard.
Looks like they anticipated your question, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, obviously the underlying or the original bill was in that same area. But so I'm really curious about how you would go about enforcing this this new piece of policy.
Ms. Gross, perhaps, or Mr. Moore, or yeah, Ms. Gross, yeah, or I'm not sure who's which of you is going to answer that.
I can
Ms. Gross, okay, please.
Thank you. So in terms of enforcing this, when we receive questions or complaints to the division, we usually handle them in a variety of manners. Sometimes we receive questions from employers and our employees, and we're just providing, we're responding to questions and providing technical assistance. At times when we receive a complaint, we also partake in something called the inform and educate process, which is basically we put the employer on notice of their obligations, their potential noncompliance with the law, and essentially work with them in a informal manner in order to help to bring the employer into compliance. We don't issue penalties when we go through the inform and educate process. If we were not successful in using the inform and educate process to bring an employer into compliance, then we may initiate an investigation in which we would speak with impacted employees, we would speak with the employer. Here we may, you know, for example, we may consult with OSHA to help us come to a determination in terms of reasonableness. And then we would issue an order which could include penalties.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my general question is, are we going to be seeing a huge request for enforcement actions based upon what we know that it's in current law and complaints that the department has received across the state?
Ms. Gross.
I think that would be difficult to determine right now. I guess I can point to that this bill obviously would apply to all employees. So we do, you know, anticipate when we have a workplace standard that applies to all employees that certainly we would see an uptick in calls and complaints in relation in relation to it.
Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is for Representative Jones, but I'd really like to understand what a statewide impact is to this and to understand how frequent of an issue. You know, this is not discrediting or saying that this isn't a challenge for some. I'm just curious if this is something that you see that has a truly statewide impact. And if it does, if it has a truly statewide impact, if it's impacting every employee or every employer in the state, I'm curious as to what amount of intensity we're going to see along these lines, and more information in that regard before we take this step to insert additional enforcement mechanisms from the government.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. And there will be, of course, more discussion on this before we be voting or addressing it. Representative Jones, comments regarding Representative Schultz's question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for that question. I think especially because we're going to be continuing to work on this, one of the things that comes to mind that we could continue investigating as this, if similar policies do exist in other states, we could take a look at that, and we could come back and have that discussion around potential level of complaints.
In particular, I guess I was going to bring this up later, but I heard the testifier talk about how this is the law in Wisconsin and other states as well, and was Minnesota law for, sounds like, multiple decades. So that could be helpful insight as well to answer Representative Schultz's question. Okay, good. We'll see. Representative Schultz, you have something else?
Yeah, no, yeah. just yeah. In wrap up, yeah. Mr. Chair, you know, we want to have the information as to how many people this is impacting. We also want to know, like, how much of a burden is this going to be on the department? Certainly, if they're fielding calls left and right from every corner of the state, certainly I think that this would have a fiscal impact to the department, and that's where my questions were.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you, Representative Schultz. We'll see if anybody has anything else. Vice Chair Meckland, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The department mentioned inform and educate, and then potentially if it goes on to penalties. But what does reasonable mean? I mean, what is the what's too many, not enough? What it doesn't really clarify. What's the legislative intent here? What it's not specifying. What is required? Can they be hard plastic chairs? Do they have to be cushion chairs? Do they, if they're cushion chairs, can they be in a meatpacking plant? Do they have to be sanitized every day? What does reasonable mean? Because there's nothing that is clarifying that here. Somebody could answer that.
So Representative Jones, perhaps you're the right person to take it, or otherwise one of the testifiers. Okay, Representative Jones, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meckland, for this question. Because we are trying to provide worker protection statewide, we wanted to make sure that we are encompassing all of that, because I think to your point that, you know, what is reasonable for a meatpacking plant is different from what's reasonable for a museum, and so that's why we wanted to give the discretion to the department.
Vice Chair Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we see this quite often where the discretion is left to the department, and then if it does run a bit away from where we intended, then, of course, there's no it certainly wasn't your fault because you didn't design it that way, I guess, or the elected person can't be held accountable by their constituents. I'm trying to visualize if I'm, like, finishing a basement or building a deck, do I have to have chairs sitting out there? Then I got to take into account the soil conditions, because if it sinks and then tips over, now I got an OSHA issue. There's a lot of different things to be taken into account. But this sounds like it stemmed out of a museum. Why are we not focusing on the museum that's not accommodating their employees rather than trying to blanketly cover every employer with yet another mandate that may or may not fit into their small little kitchen because greasy floors, tight spaces, as was mentioned by many. And then to leave it so openly vague to just say reasonable and let somebody else decide what reasonable means. That's my final comment. Thank you, Mr.
Thanks
Chair.
Thanks so much, Vice Chair Meckland. I'm not, I think, not seeing anybody else. I'll send it to you, Representative Jones, to close and to respond to any of that. I'll note that I am interested in how this works in other states and the past Minnesota law. I'm getting information that it was repealed in the 1970s. So it was actually in place for a long time. So understanding how that works. And I may be able to just note that it's quite common in laws that we do use the word reasonable or reasonably. And then there's some case law that builds up to interpret that. But Representative Jones, closing on your bill.
Yeah, thank you all for the discussion, and I look forward to further conversation to hopefully include this going forward.
Yeah, and I assume, Representative Jones, you're very open to conversation with your colleagues as they kind of want to understand this better and provide input. Thank you. Well, thank you to you. Thank you to all the testifiers. With that, the chair lays over House File 3796 as amended. And we are now moving to House File 4131. Vice Chair Greenman's heading up on that bill, and she moves House File 4131 for re-referral to the Commerce Committee. Is the plan. This relates to wage and surveillance-based price and wage discrimination. Vice Chair Greenman, you have an A3 amendment, and you wish to move that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Can you just briefly say what the A3 amendment does?
Yeah, this is and I'll just note, this bill was heard in Commerce on the pricing. It's going back to Commerce, ideally, and we'll vote on it there. So I'm going to limit, and what we did in the amendment here is really related to the wage piece. Okay. It is related to some feedback, some technical feedback I got to make it work better from DLI.
Okay. Members, any discussion or questions regarding the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So the bill is amended, and Vice Chair Greenman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. We are here to talk about 4131, the wage discrimination piece. It is about protecting our workers and our labor markets from predatory practice of surveillance or personal-based wage discrimination. What is surveillance wage discrimination? Imagine you're a gig worker and you open up your food delivery app after you completed an assigned task and delivery, and then you're paid a specific price. When you run into your neighbor who's completed a similar task to the same restaurant, same neighborhood, but they got $4 more. Now, you don't know how your wage was set or the information the company used to set that wage, but you do know that you got a lot less for essentially the same task. And you know that the company you work for has been collecting an immense amount of information on you. They know the rides you've done, but they also know you bought a new car, that you recently moved to town, that you maybe had an eviction notice at your last place. So they know you need the work. Is that why they're paying you less? Companies are gobbling up data on us everywhere you go. They're buying it, they're scraping it, they're collecting it from both public and non-public sources. They're collecting an immense amount of data on the app that you're working on if you're doing that, and then they are buying and acquiring it from both other companies and data companies. These companies are then using and applying AI models to all that personal data, and they are investing billions of dollars in this pricing and this wage technology and experiments to determine, in this price context, how much you're willing to pay for something, and in the wage context, how much will you be willing to work for. If we allow companies to use personal data that's unrelated to the specific task at hand, unrelated to the work, then companies are free to spy on you and offer personalized wages based on what they think you will be willing to take. No more equal pay for equal work, instead personalized wages to pay you less. And to be clear, this is not about market-based forces, supply and demand, the price of labor. This is about wages set based on you, tailored to find the minimum amount you will work for and then paying you that. And if you're one of these gig companies, if you're one of these companies that's setting wages this way, you're in the business of generating revenue and making money. You can see that appeal. You've already invested a lot of money in the collecting of data into these AI-powered models, and now you can use it to keep your labor costs down by determining how much each individual person will do for this task. And then you offer the wage. Folks can't compare it with others. They're not comparable, and all without workers even knowing why they are offered the price they're offered. These companies can drive down labor costs in a way that hurts small businesses who can't compete because they aren't in this business of gobbling up data and merging and all of those things. They can't compete with big tech. And you can save a lot of money by surveilling people and using wage discrimination. Now, these tools are new, but the strategy of targeting vulnerable workers and charging them less is not new. Before anti-discrimination laws, companies paid people of color less, they paid women less, they hired children and paid them less, and Lots of that's still happening, to be sure, but it is illegal because of anti-discrimination laws. Because as a matter of policy, we believe people should be paid based on the work they do and not based on how desperate you are to get a paycheck. But economic vulnerability is not a legally protected class. And now companies who they have this information on you, even information you haven't shared, can use that. The scariest part is that they refuse to even share exactly the data they are using, collecting, or informing their decisions about how they sign you wages. The impact of this surveillance wage models is wide-ranging. Lower wages, more data collection, less competition, and billionaires controlling even more of our lives. So the long story short is it's time to act before big tech normalizes surveillance waging. Let's put some guardrails on this. What this bill does is it bans the practice of surveillance-based waging, defined as using an automated decision-making system to inform individualized wages based on surveillance data regarding the workers. It also requires these companies to have procedures to ensure for both compliance with the law and accuracy that it, of the data it's using, allowing workers to request that data that's being considered in what their wages they're being given. What this bill does not do, does not prevent companies from offering wages, bonuses, or material conditions that's based on the differences of the cost of workers providing that labor or related to the tasks the workers is performing. And it's not a dynamic pricing bill. Offering bonuses to everybody to get people to go someplace, that is not affected. This is about individualized data on individualized people. So the real question for us is why would we let these giant tech companies develop models to spy on us and then use those to pay us less, while at the same time charging consumers more, all without telling us how they even are setting those wages? Workers are being nickel and dimed. AI has the power to supercharge that by personalizing this ripoff just to you. So this is our chance together here to put a stop to that, focus on what wages should be focused on, which is supply and demand and the work getting done. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think we have some testifiers.
Good. Thank you so much. There's a couple of changes in the testifiers. Instead of the first testifier, Sam Diaz, I believe, is going to be testifying. So make your way up. And then the next testifier will be Aaron Rosenthal. And then we'll get back to what's on the list. Welcome back up. Ciaz, if you can please remind us who you are and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Samantha Diaz from SEIU Local 26. We represent over 8,000 janitors, security officers, high-rise window cleaners, and airport passenger service workers across the Twin Cities metro area. Our members are primarily low-income, people of color, women, and immigrant workers, and we are actually particularly concerned about how wage surveillance-based discrimination is emerging in our security industry and in our commercial janitorial industry, particularly in warehouses. We appreciate House File 4131 as it addresses a growing problem. The use of automated data systems and surveillance data, like personal characteristics, behaviors, and even biometrics to set individual wages. We know they disproportionately, folks who we represent, low-wage workers and communities of color, reinforcing existing inequities while making it harder for workers to understand or challenge decisions that affect their livelihoods. In our industries, workers are already experiencing how data and algorithm management shapes their schedules, their assignments, their earnings, often with little to no transparency. And at the same time, consumers are facing rising costs that may be influenced by the same surveillance-based systems. That is why transparency and accountability is critical, again, for, you know, schedules, assignments, earnings. And without it, big tech companies and employers can continue to promote a positive narrative about their innovation. Meanwhile, our workers and the public remain in the dark about the true breadth and scale of these impacts have on our daily lives. To us, it's common sense, this legislation. So thank you, Representative Greenman. And it also ensures that companies cannot use surveillance data to unfairly discriminate in wages. While allowing legitimate pricing differences based on real costs or recognized discounts. So thank you for the time.
And thank you so much. And then Aaron Rosenthal, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Aaron Rosenthal, the research director at North Star Policy Action, a think tank dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. Some of you may remember that I was here last week to talk about the role of artificial intelligence in the Minnesota workforce. At that time, I presented results from a study I conducted with Dr. Manjeet Rege at the University of St. Thomas, where we found that 1 in 3 workers in Minnesota are at risk of high exposure to generative AI in their job. 1 in 3 workers is a lot, but in many ways it's a significant undercount of the impact that AI will have. And one of the ways in which it is an undercount is surveillance wages. When surveillance wages are allowed, as have already been described, it's not 1 in 3 workers who are at risk. It is every working Minnesotan that is now threatened by having AI impact their work. And the harms of that threat are significant. First, it violates fairness in the workplace by creating a system in which the employer knows the rules and the workers do not. Workers often don't know what data is being collected about them, how that data is being interpreted, if that data is even accurate, and how it's being used to influence their pay. That makes it extremely difficult for workers to know when they are being treated unfairly or to challenge it if they are being treated unfairly. Moreover, wage surveillance like this raises significant privacy concerns, especially if workers' personal data is being collected and utilized without their knowledge. Second, wage surveillance undermines the basic principle that wages should reflect the work being done. I would hope that we all believe pay should be based on the job performed and the value of it, not on a hidden calculation about how little a particular worker can be induced to accept. Third, surveillance wages open the door to exploitation of economic vulnerability. Imagine a company using personal data to conclude that a worker is carrying significant consumer debt. In a fair labor market, that vulnerability would not be a reason to offer lower pay, but under a surveillance wage model, that same debt can become an opportunity for an employer to push wages down. That is what makes surveillance wages so disturbing. The same circumstances that make a worker economically vulnerable can become a basis for paying them less, creating a vicious cycle of AI-powered poverty and exploitation. Notably, wage surveillance is not just about ride-sharing apps, so that's often where the focus goes. Gig work may give us some of the clearest examples of its use, but make no mistake, the rising power of AI opens the doors to substantially more data collection and utilization in almost any work arrangement. Without regulation, surveillance wages could become an increasingly common feature of contemporary work across sectors. To stop the pervasive spread of this model, we should, at a minimum, insist on 2 principles. First, wages should be tied to the work performed, period, not to data unrelated to the task at hand. None of us should want a future in which someone is offered a lower wage because an algorithm predicts that they will become pregnant. Second, workers should know what data is being collected about them and used to inform their wages, helping to maintain a balance of power between employers and employees. Without these basic protections, we are allowing compensation to be shaped by hidden surveillance and unaccountable systems, building a labor market where privacy is diminished, power is concentrated, and past vulnerabilities become a powerful tool for future wage suppression. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for your work. So I'll ask the next 2 testifiers to both make your way up, Jerome Brogy and Jonathan Cotter. And I think we'll go in the order on our agenda here. So, Jerome Brogy, once you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Jerome Brogy with Chamber of Progress. We're a center-left tech industry association working to ensure all people benefit from technological advances. We share this committee's concern about affordability, and we appreciate the committee's efforts to ensure consumers are getting a fair deal. But I am here today to ask you to oppose HF 4131. As written, the bill would not just target bad actors,
it would eliminate, and our concerns are primarily about the way the impact on small businesses and consumers, it would eliminate the everyday discounts and promotions that Minnesota families rely on every day to stretch their budgets. For a coffee shop offering you a discount because you haven't visited in a while, a grocery app sending you a coupon for the cereal that your family buys every week, a new brand at your local store, sending a coupon to shoppers who already buy similar products, reaching likely buyers. These practices would all be banned because the bill does not make any distinction between using data to charge a consumer more and using data to offer them a lower price. The bill's only exemptions cover uniform discounts and groups and discounts offered to groups like seniors and veterans. This leaves out most of the ways consumers receive savings today. Despite widespread concern, we do want to emphasize that there is no comprehensive evidence that businesses are actually using these tools to raise prices on individual consumers. In the highly competitive retail market, this makes sense. Consumers can compare prices with a few taps on their phones. Using data to overcharge consumers is a losing strategy when a competitor can simply offer a better deal. This also isn't just about large corporations. More than a third of small businesses now use data-driven pricing tools, most commonly to optimize discounts and promotion. And
Mr. Ambrosi, can I just pause you for a second? The focus in this committee is on the wage discrimination. That's within our jurisdiction. The price discrimination is in the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee. Do you have any comments regarding the wage side of this, or are you?
Absolutely, yeah. And I apologize for that.
No problem.
I think the primary concern regarding which applies to both the wage and the prices, yeah, is the requirements around disclosure and dispute procedures. Okay. The definition of automated decision system is broad enough to incorporate really, from my reading, even the use of an equation in a spreadsheet. And what this would do to small businesses and other platforms using tools like this is force them to disclose their use, but also the sensitive inputs that go into that use, and build the infrastructure to allow any individual consumer or worker to dispute a price or a wage. And we just think that is a tremendous burden to put on even a large corporation and could be existential for a small business. And with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being here. And then finally to Mr. Cotter, identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, Vice Chair Meckland, and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Cotter, Director of Healthcare and Commerce Policy with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. On behalf of the Chamber and our 6,300 member businesses from every corner of the state, we appreciate the intent behind this proposal. Consumers and workers should be treated fairly in the marketplace. However, we have significant concerns with House File 4131 as amended. I'll briefly touch on the commerce concerns, but we do believe that those are broad sweeping definitions that need to be narrowed. But beyond just the pricing of goods, this similarly oversteps into management of workplaces directly, seeking to impose a new regulatory framework, addressing what the bill characterizes as surveillance-based wage discrimination. House File 4131 takes an expansive view of what constituents wage, reaching beyond direct compensation to include bonuses, commissions, incentives, scheduling, and task management, as well as other factors that influence earnings. In doing so, this bill risks pulling routine day-to-day workforce management decisions into a regulatory framework designed for wage discrimination, potentially creating new compliance burdens and procedural requirements for employers managing their operations. Following recent substantial changes in the workplace regulatory environment over the last 3 years, employers need to have the autonomy to make staffing decisions and provide wages, benefits, and schedules that are appropriate for their workplace and responsive to workplace needs. Workplaces in Minnesota are already heavily regulated. The Chamber continues to oppose the increasing number of workplace mandates by the legislature to interfere with this dynamic. For these reasons, we cannot support House File 4131. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll see. Is anybody else, many other members of the public, wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any. So we're going to move to member discussion and questions. Representative Wayne Johnson, you're up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just am a little confused, so I just have a quick clarification. I know when the previous presenter was up there, you said this is directed towards wages, but I see, I guess I just need to be clear. It says based on price and wage discrimination in the bill. So we're not talking about prices?
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson. So the bill itself includes addresses both price and wage discrimination. That's why the bill will be sent back to the Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction on the price side. But if the bill just said prohibition on surveillance-based price discrimination, said nothing about wages, it wouldn't be in our committee. And vice versa, if it was just about wages, it wouldn't be in the Commerce Committee. So my point is that the jurisdiction of this committee is on the wage discrimination portion of the bill.
That concerns me a little bit, and I guess I'm trying to understand, because the bill does address both prices and wages, and we can concentrate on the wages we want, but the fact that the bill actually takes into account prices is something that we have to take into consideration.
To the extent that there's provisions of the bill that address both, that's obviously relevant. It's just that if wage discrimination were not part of the bill, if it's just price discrimination, it wouldn't be in our committee's area. And you know how different committees will focus on the portions of the bill that relate to that committee's jurisdiction. That's my point.
Were we looking to move this out of the committee, though?
Moving the bill to Commerce to address the price discrimination portion and make final decision regarding it.
And Mr. Chair,
Vice Chair,
we've already
please.
Had about a 45 minutes of hearing on the price piece, and it's going back to Commerce. So the Committee of Jurisdiction around the price restriction has both had testimony, and had committee discussion. It's going back, and it's on the agenda this week for Commerce. So this piece needed to come to Labor. Right. It's a clone bill to allow Commerce to have more time with it, but it needed to come to Labor for the price discrimination part of the bill.
Okay.
Representative Johnson, back to you.
No, thank you.
Okay, Representative Mueller, looks like you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just confused about the path of this bill, because if we're supposed to be passing it today, but you're supposed to hear it tomorrow in Commerce, is there a clone someplace and it didn't go anywhere? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, we'll have Vice Chair Greenman, you can explain.
Thank you. The original of this bill, it's the same bill, was heard in Commerce 2 weeks ago, and they laid it over partially to then we put it here, and in order to hear this piece, it is the original bill is being heard there, but it is the language, the labor language, could go in that bill or could not based on what happens in this hearing.
Representative Mueller, is that kind of...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from what I'm understanding from the research we're looking at, the original bill is $37.94.
Right.
And laid over, but we're trying to meet deadlines, so we're trying to do this new thing here. Just confused about why we're hearing multiple things at the same time. And I understand we're only focusing on one part of the bill. I get that.
Yeah.
For a person that has had to have a bill sent to multiple committees, sometimes... For no reason, I am wondering why we're trying to dual track this right now on deadline week.
I think the purpose is to make sure that each committee that has jurisdiction will hear and decide on the portion of the bill within its jurisdiction. That's the goal. Vice Chair Greenman, correct?
Yeah, that is the goal, and this is happening all over committees since I've been at the legislature. It was important that we had this labor provision or this provision around wages in this committee, and so I got it cloned right away in order to make sure it got here and could be heard on the schedule.
And maybe I'll just add, we want to make sure that a portion of a bill that's in a committee's jurisdiction has a hearing in that committee and then gets a vote in that committee, and so that's the goal. So we now will have that happen in our committee. Representative Mueller, back to you, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Greenman, I came in at the same time as you. We are in the same freshman class. And so while I have heard of people who have wanting to have clone bills because they have separate things that they're looking at, I honestly have not seen someone who said, I have one bill that I want passed, and I know I have to have it at multiple committees. If we think about the cannabis bill that went to 13 different committees, and that's why they started it super early. And so, again, for someone who's had to have a bill go to multiple different places, I'm just saying the dual trackness makes this a little confusing for me, and it makes me, I get it. I'm just saying I haven't seen this practice as common as what you're talking about.
And I'll maybe say I have seen it quite a bit. I understand your concern, Representative Mueller, and I think the most important thing is we want to make sure that each committee, like, for example, if wage discrimination didn't pass through our committee, that would be a major concern. So we want to make sure our committee makes a decision about that portion. Representative Schultz, to you then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, this is in 325D, and my question for you is, if this is having to do with wage discrimination, shouldn't that be under the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor and Industry?
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you. And I appreciate that question, and I appreciate the work, because this is dealing with a very narrow issue, which is about the data, using surveillance-based data as it applies to any, basically, the price of labor, right? That price of labor could be to an employee, it could be through a contract, but what we're talking about here is setting that price that you are paying someone to do a task. It felt consistent and congruent to do it as an unfair trade practice. Now, it is not dealing with, it is not a discrimination bill. It is not dealing with that. If you are interested, and I think that Representative Godfrey's bill may take a different approach, but this is an approach that I think they're pursuing in Colorado, because it is specifically dealing with the data side of using, and as you heard from the testifiers who spoke mostly to the price side, they are saying it operates in the same way, and that's how we chose to do it as simplest to address it.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm actually pretty curious about this, whether or not the Department of Commerce would have enforcement mechanisms for wage discrimination. And I guess I'll start with that first question.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you. The way that this enforcement mechanism works, and again, I'd love to work with you on mechanism if you want to. This is going to Commerce, and so we're not passing it directly to the General Register if you want to talk about it. The way that this works is the way other unfair trade practices work when we're limiting that, and so it would be through private right of action in the public interest and the Attorney General's office. It doesn't actually have a Commerce regulatory structure right now. It's the same way that we do other unfair trade practices that in statute.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question that I think, like, gets to the heart of this piece of legislation to begin with is this something impacting workers in Minnesota today? And to understand its scale today, we as a legislature can always seek to be preventative. We can always seek to address things that are hypothetical. And I would especially like us to center ourselves there from a perspective of, if we pass legislation, we are impacting commerce, the way that our economy has the ability to grow, and how these systems are set up. And that oftentimes could come as a detriment to the future of work and the growth in our economy. And so I'm really curious as to how this is currently impacting Minnesota's workers.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you raise a really important question, because as you heard, right now workers don't know. We don't require disclosure. And we heard in the Misclass Task Force a year and a half ago, we heard a gig worker say, I believe I'm being paid less for the same job, and I believe it is this. And we had Uber come and say, that's not this. And I said, well, what are the inputs you're putting in to this price, or to this price of labor, to this contract you say you have? And they wouldn't tell us. They said that's proprietary. That's part of why disclosure is here. We believe, and on the surveillance pricing side, we know because they're saying it on earnings calls. On the surveillance wage setting side, we know they're running experiments, but they don't actually, we do not have a disclosure law, which is part of this bill. But if you want to talk about, I think, Mr. Rosenthal talked about, ensuring that there's actual transparency around what information is being collected, around how that information is being used, actually is how we will tell. So I do actually believe there's a problem, and I think that the resistance of these companies, as we've heard, to even disclosure is part of it. This is a lucrative business practice. So I think we are both fixing a problem that, as we heard, right now we're seeing the gig economy and has potential to spread everywhere, as we've seen. But the disclosure piece is a key thing of right now. We don't know. We don't require it even as regulatory disclosure to our agencies.
Representative Schultz, finding...
Thank you. It would just appear that this piece of legislation needs more work. I imagine that Representative Greenman will continue to work on those things, whether that's talking about which section of statute it should be in, whether it is understanding a greater scale as to the people who are impacted by it. And thirdly, from that, Mr. Chair, I think it's really about the enforcement mechanism, too, to ensure that we're caring for workers and the future of our economy well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll let Vice Chair Greenman respond in your final comments, if I can. So let's move on a little bit. Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Before I get started, I would like to request a roll call on this one.
Okay, there will be a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing this forward. I want to think about what we're actually talking about here. We've heard about some process concerns or some process questions, concerns about maybe the enforcement of it. But the underlying problem of having workers bid lower and lower and lower for work that we all say provides value, and that's whether that's an Uber or Lyft driver, whether it's when we talked about Uber for nursing a couple weeks ago, where they put these things out and they have nurses bid lower and lower on these different shifts. This is a problem. I mean, this is literally a race to the bottom in wages, how we can bid as low as possible for our labor when we should be looking at it in a much more holistic effort, putting guardrails in place so that we don't have these things continue to take advantage of our workers. The concern about hypotheticals. We just heard a bunch of hypotheticals about putting seats in dirt, and that's why we should vote this bill down, because of these hypotheticals. We hear that. This is a real problem, and when we talk about trying to address it now before there's more and more people here to testify about how this has been impacting them, we have an opportunity to put those guardrails in place right now to say, look, we're not going to do surveillance wage setting where they can offer you lower and lower based on your credit score, based on your purchase history, based on your debt, based on your rent, all these other things. We can put guardrails in place right now to protect workers as we go into the future, as AI continues to expand. And I just appreciate the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Kozlowski, did you have something? Yeah, look, okay, yeah. Vice Chair Mecklen, I'll close with you for your side. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and Representative Greenman for bringing this bill forward. I think as we continue to tackle and just trying to put some lines on the road with AI and what we're seeing around price surveillance and price setting, we're seeing this. Obviously, as we're having this conversation with consumers, with workers, we're also tackling it in the Housing Committee. We're seeing it go a step further and not just the price surveillance in using data to set rents, but actually then to set further up colluding together amongst landlords and corporations. And so just thank you for the work on this. I want to bring it back to something that you talked about, which was that how this is really purposely opaque, and I'm particularly concerned, as you talked about, just the giant gap around the discrimination and the legal risk, frankly, that it puts businesses at who are using these tools, but also the workers. I mean, we know that Staples and Amazon got caught. The reason that this got caught in the first place is that people noticed, by zip code, if they were a member, that they were getting different pricing. We saw Princeton Review charge for the test preparation for Asian populations differently than they did for other populations. And similarly, we're seeing Shipt, which is run by Target, Instacart, Postmates have been doing this price wage setting. Amazon Flex recently installed AI cameras that actually spy on workers, and they're able to, well, in many cases, wrongly put an offense, a traffic safety violation on a worker that didn't occur, and that makes them ineligible for bonuses and shortchanges their income. And so as I'm hearing colleagues and testifiers talk about how this is going to shut the door for workers on wages. It is slamming the door on them. And this isn't a hypothetical. We saw Roosevelt Institute recently put out a report, as Representative Johnson talked about, for nursing, that at a time when we just saw a report come out this week, that if they're using data to give less pay but expect more work, at a time that Minnesotans' 50% increase of foreclosure and bankruptcies and credit card companies saying that Minnesotans are pulling out their 401k to pay their rent, to pay their house, to pay medical debt, it is to me atrocious that we would ever allow this to continue happening and gobbling up on the backs of workers, but also Minnesotans. So thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. Vice Chair McClend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting. I think Chair Pinto and I are the only two that have been around here long enough to remember the one and only Chair Mahoney, which he worked diligently to pass the wage theft law back then, and he testified in doing so that we know, this was his words, 99.9% of all employers do everything right, but it's that one-tenth of 1% that we have to fix, out of which came a lot of paperwork for those 99.9% of stuff that they got to do to be compliant with yet another law. So I find that part of this interesting. However, you said a private right of action would become a thing. That's how it would be handled in this. And in doing so, I would guess that there would probably be, once you bring awareness to it, you pass a law and another thing, that there would be more and more of those type of case filings, which I find it that there's not a fiscal note to this bill. But if this would not then incur more costs to the AG's office, and how you're accounting for that.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I neglected to, the fiscal note for the bill that is in Commerce came back, the AG's office looked at it for both the pricing and wage side and said that there wasn't a fiscal note. I can make sure to get you the copy of that fiscal note, but it was the same.
No cost. Okay. Vice Chair Mecklen, you've got a colleague who looks like he may want to hop in. Representative Schultz, a brief.
Yeah, I will just say quickly that I hope that then that we can hold that accountable, make it that noted in record that they cannot come back later and ask for more money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It is noted. It is now on the House website that they are saying that there's no cost. Representative Schultz, real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, just based upon this last exchange, if there is no fiscal cost to the Attorney General's office to do private right of action to this very topic, then that says that there may not be an issue.
Well, you may want to look at
if there are big needs across the state and many people who are coming to the Attorney General's office for this request, according to the Attorney General's office, then this is not currently an issue.
We'll let Vice Chair Greenman address that and anything else
you.
He wishes.
Yeah, so thank you. A private right of action is individual private people suing in the public interest.
Right.
The AG could sue, and I think that in their fiscal note they said that this would go into their consumer and their unfair trade, so they already have lawyers doing this. But as Representative Mecklen said, we assume that 99.9% of the employers are actually going to follow the law in the first place. And so the enforcement mechanism you talk about, part of why we are changing the law and being specific about what data you can and can't use, is that we assume that the big change will happen because these employers will be compliant and follow the law. And that's, I think, what the AG was factoring in to their fiscal note.
And then to your close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate this discussion on the substance, because as you heard Mr. Rosenthal say, employers know the rules and workers do not. And in this case, we heard the chamber say employers should provide wages, benefits, schedules responsive to the workplace. That's all this bill is doing. It is saying that you cannot use personalized data that is not related to the task that people are performing or those workplace demands to set wages. So if we don't stop this, we are greenlighting what we know is starting right now and we know is spreading, that companies to be able to spy on you and then offer you a personalized wage based on how low they think of a wage you'll be willing to take. That's all this does. It is about eliminating personalized wages and the data that is being used to do it and making sure that workers know in order to be able to make sure that folks are compliant with the law. And with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we will proceed to a vote. All right, thank you, Representative Greenman, and thanks to all the testifiers. With that, Representative Greenman renews her motion on House File 4131 as amended, be recommended for referral to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. We'll have the clerk take the roll.
Chair Pinto?
Aye.
Chair Pinto, aye. Chair Baker, excused. Vice Chair Greenman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Greenman, aye. Vice Chair Mecklen?
Nay.
Vice Chair Mecklen, nay. Rep. Bakeberg?
No.
Rep. Bakeberg, no. Rep. Berg?
Yes.
Rep. Berg, aye. Rep. Frazier?
Aye.
Rep. Frazier, aye. Rep. Hussein? Aye. Rep. Hussein, aye. Rep. Pete Johnson?
Aye.
Rep. Pete Johnson, aye. Rep. Wayne Johnson?
No.
Rep. Wayne Johnson, no. Rep. Kozlowski?
Aye.
Rep. Kozlowski, aye. Rep. Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Rep. Mueller, no. Rep. Schultz?
Schultz, no.
Rep. Schultz, no. Rep. Salenzikar? Rep. Salenzikar, no. Chair, there are 7 ayes, 6 nays, and 1 excused.
Okay, thank you so much, Ms. Timio. So despite there being 7 ayes and 6 nays under the terms of the power sharing agreement, the bill motion fails. The bill is not proceeding at this time. I'll maybe just note we've had a lot of discussions about the impact of AI on the workforce, and let's continue those discussions because really important. Really important topic that's going to continue hitting us and our workforce hard. Mr. Bowdery, thank you for making your way up. Members, we're going to close with a presentation by Deed on a couple of youth workforce development programs. This is continuing the conversation about how we structure grants. I'll note that on Thursday, we will be receiving a report on a review by Deed of their competitive grant processes. We're going to be hearing a couple bills coming up that came in as direct appropriations and being converted to competitive grants. And of course, we had quite a robust conversation on the House floor yesterday about some issues relating to this as well. But I wanted to focus in on the youth competitive grant programs a little bit and just understand them better. And we're working on getting things plugged in. Okay.
Thank you.
And so, Mr. Bowdery, if you can please maybe identify yourself, if you can, for the record, and then proceed with your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Devin Bowdery, Deed Government Relations Director, here to present on a couple of Deed's youth programs, namely Youth at Work and Youth Build programs. Both of these are codified and have been long-running programs as part of Deed's workforce development portfolio. And the eligibility criteria amongst both of these programs is pretty well-defined in those statutes. So to begin with Youth at Work, this is a program that began in 2013 as a pilot program and was later codified in 2016. It provides grants to organizations that serve youth defined as ages 14 to 24 who are economically disadvantaged or have at least one at-risk characteristic. There are about a dozen or so characteristics underneath that. For example, those that are pregnant or parenting, youth with limited English proficiency, foster youth, and those who have dropped out or at risk of dropping out of school. And in addition, priority in grant programs, grant awards is given to programs that provides students with information about education and training requirements for careers in high growth or in-demand sectors that serve youth with communities of color who are underrepresented in the workforce or serve youth with disabilities. And organizations, I didn't include this on the slide, but eligible organizations include schools, tribes, nonprofits, local governments. So some of the past grantees include Step Up and Right Track, from Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as the Duluth Yes program and many others. Looking through the report.
Mr. Bowdery, can I actually just pause you? Well, yeah, as you're mentioning organizations, I'm seeing in the report that's in our packet and online pages 3 and 4 that list organizations that received grants in the last cycles. That you named a couple, but for the full list, we can look in the report. Yes?
Yep, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Apologies for the strange stapling, everybody, but hopefully you make it work. So, Mr. Bowdery, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know that there is a maximum grants award that is set in statute, but the highest is around 700-some thousand to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then the smallest awards I've seen are around 50,000.
Okay. And we can see those award amounts right in the report that's in your packet, members. So, okay.
Eligible activities include employment preparation, job training activities that support youth and industry-recognized credentials with specific industry certifications, paid internships and work experiences, financial literacy trainings, academic support activities that prevent youth from dropping out of school, and post-secondary education support activities. So really geared around sort of a young person's first job experience, first milestone in life. And just highlighting a few of the youth at work outcomes, close to 11,800 youth served, 78% being from a community of color, and 17% served that have a disability. And also in the report, you'll find much more detailed, disaggregated outcome information from this program.
Mr. Bowdery, just pausing on this slide for a second. Members, I'm interested in the outcomes issue, right? Because we want to know, like, what are we actually getting? I mean, knowing the number of youth served is one thing, but we want to know, like, well, actually what's happening. I'm seeing this line towards the bottom that says attained work readiness or and/or education goals. Mr. Bowdery, are those goals that are set by the young person themselves? And, like, can you just expand on what that means? Because that does feel like a pretty good outcome. If you set a goal and then you achieve the goal, that's great. But can you just expand on that?
Yeah. I'd have to check back on some of the more details, but given this is geared to at-risk youth, so both this program and the Youth Build, working on trying to get keep kids in school and kind of help them complete their education or an equivalent. So like with the Youth Build program, you'll see some outcomes that are students that completed their high school degree or at least got back on track to completing that. So those types of outcomes.
Okay. Maybe you're interested in more on that, though. Okay, yeah, and please keep going. I want to make sure we at least have a couple minutes for questions. So,
and moving on to Youth Build, at a very high level, this serves at-risk youth, largely in the construction sector, with a dual purpose of having them work on restoring housing for particularly the homeless, and sort of a social service component to their work. And I'll get into more of that in a coming slide. So eligibility, youth must be between the ages of 16 to 24, so slightly different from youth at work, but that's set out in statute. Youth that have not completed a high school diploma or its equivalent, and again, those that are at risk of dropping out or have dropped out, and also economically disadvantaged or eligible for the high school graduation incentives program, which is codified under 124D.68. Currently, there are about 10 Youth Build grantees. The maximum award is $150,000, and similar eligible organizations, nonprofits, school districts, local governments. Some of the organizations that have received awards include Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, Central Minnesota Jobs and Training Services, and Goodwill Easter Seals. Program components, so each award must be based around these four items, and this is set in statute. So first, an education component, which requires participants to complete or work toward their secondary education or literacy advancement, work experience, which provides vocational skills training, and I'll get into some of the eligible construction activities on the next slide. Job readiness skills, so at least 20% of programming must provide job readiness skills, job search, placement, assistance, and particularly within the building trades, unions, self-employment, or other employment opportunities. And lastly, for criteria, leadership training and peer support, each program must provide meaningful opportunities to develop leadership skills, problem solving, and negotiating. Eligible construction activities include, and rehabilitation projects include those that are for residential units, for low-income families or individuals, for homeless people, improvements to energy efficiency or environmental health of a residential facility, and facilities and incidental structures which provide education, social services, health services, gardening services, and serve low-income communities, families, or individuals. And again, outcomes similar to Youth at Work. These are much more disaggregated within the report, but this one served five.
And actually, I might probably, rather than having you read every detail word on the slide, we'll just sort of have this available. Maybe I'll have you push to the to just talk about the funding, the final slide. And if folks have questions regarding the outcome slide,
yes,
they can ask that, and then so see the amounts.
Last slide here is just a recap of what it was funded at last session. So Youth at Work, $750,000 each year from the general fund and $4.348 million from the Workforce Development Fund. And with Youth at Work in particular, the demand almost always exceeds what we are appropriated. So in this last go-round, we had about four times more in ask, about 80 applicants to the program. And Youth Build receives about $1 million a year, and funding has been built into the base and is typically stable year to year for these programs. And just want to end on a note about the RFPs for youth programs in particular. These come out the winter before a budget year most often, so that we can get applicants into the process and time it, the awards and the funding, with when school lets out, so that programs are ready for the summer.
Good. So, and the programs are ready for funding during a budget year, too, so we can get going quickly. Members, we're obviously, it's pretty tight on time, but I want to squeeze anything in that anybody has. Representative Johnson? Yeah, Wayne Johnson? And we'll, yeah.
I just have a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm just, the ages between 14 and 24, just curious. Why 24? How was the upper age determined as what a youth is?
Mr. Bowdery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's set out in Minnesota statute, and I think it also aligns with federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act definitions for youth. So just trying to keep
it. Okay, thank you.
And, yeah, and, it is, and so Youth at Work is codified at 116.562, so ultimately that was a legislative decision and certainly one we could change if we wanted to. Yeah. Representative Hussein. I thought I saw your hand. Maybe I did, maybe you didn't. Okay. Was there anybody else then has anything that they wish to add? Or maybe, and I believe that the Youth at Work was a significant increase in funding this past biennium, as I recall. I'm seeing Ms. Zhang nodding. And I believe that Youth Build is a federally required program, Mr. Bowdery, or it's, yeah?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if federally required. There is a federal analog program.
Okay.
There's a federal Youth Build that runs through the U.S. Department of Labor. None of that money runs through us. Organizations apply directly.
Definitely. Okay. And I guess I'll just use this as an opportunity to ask organizations that are working with young people, we'd love to hear, Chair Baker and I would, ways in which, you know, Youth at Work is a pretty broad program, ways in which it is not working for you, where you'd say, oh, we would not have been eligible for that or wouldn't work for us in some way. We'd like to know that about that program, and then that'll be true for programs in other areas of our budget as well. So not seeing any other hands. Mr. Bowdery, thank you so much. Vice Chair Mecklund, any preview you can provide for tomorrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we'll be hearing a couple of bills, break law and paid medical leave, I think are two of them that are up for tomorrow.
Thank you so much. Members, thanks for the discussion. With that, the meeting is adjourned.